tie up the narrative and finish the tale. I get the feeling from what she wrote that she just kind of pooped out. The guide stared at him for a moment through her steel-rimmed glasses and wondered why the visitors couldn't behave just that little bit more like sheep. Sadly, his point was a valid one. She herself had often pondered the diluted ending, wishing, like millions of others, that circumstances had allowed Jane and Rochester to marry after all. "Some things will never be known," she replied non-committally. "Charlotte is no longer with us, so the question is abstract. What we have to study and enjoy is what she has left us. The sheer exuberance of the writing easily outweighs any of its small shortcomings." The young American nodded, and the small crowd moved on, my aunt and uncle among them. I hung back until only I and a single Japanese tourist were left in the room. I then tried to look at the original manuscript on tiptoe. It was tricky, as I was small for my age. "Would you like me to read it for you?" said a kindly voice close at hand. It was the Japanese tourist. She smiled at me, and I thanked her for her trouble. She checked that no one was around, unfolded her reading glasses, and started to speak. She spoke excellent English, and had a fine reading voice. The words peeled off the page into my imagination as she spoke. "In those days I was young, and all sorts of fancies, bright and dark, tenanted my mind. The memories of nursery stories were there amongst other rubbish, and when they recurred, maturing youth added to them a vigour and vividness beyond what childhood could give." I closed my eyes, and a thin chill suddenly filled the air around me. The tourist's voice was clear now, as though speaking in the open air, and when I opened my eyes, the museum had gone. In its place was a country lane of another place entirely. It was a fine winter's evening, and the sun was just dipping below the horizon. The air was perfectly still, the colour washed from the scene. Apart from a few birds that stirred occasionally in the hedge, no movement punctuated the starkly beautiful landscape. I shivered as I saw my own breath in the crisp air, zipped up my jacket, and regretted that I had left my hat and mittens on the peg downstairs. As I looked about, I could see that I was not alone. Barely 10 feet away, a young woman, dressed in a cloak and bonnet, was sitting on a stile watching the moon that had just risen behind us. When she turned, I could see that her face was plain and outwardly unremarkable, yet possessed of a bearing that showed inner strength and resolve. I stared at her intently with a mixture of feelings. I had realized not long ago that I myself was no beauty, and even at the age of 9 had seen how the more attractive children gained favour more easily. But here in that young woman I could see how those principles could be inverted. I felt myself stand more upright and clench my jaw in subconscious mimicry of her pose. I was just thinking about asking her where the museum had gone when a sound in the lane made us both turn. It was an approaching horse, and the young woman seemed startled for a moment. The lane was narrow, and I stepped back to give the horse room to pass. As I waited, a large black-and-white dog rushed along the hedge, nosing the ground for anything of interest. The dog ignored the figure on the stile, but stopped dead in his tracks when he saw me. His tail wagged enthusiastically, and he bounded over, sniffing me inquisitively, his hot breath covering me in a warm cloak and his whiskers tickling my cheek. I giggled, and the dog wagged his tail even harder. He had sniffed along this hedge during every single reading of the book for over 130 years, but had never come across anything that smelt so, well, real. He licked me several times with great affection. I giggled again and pushed him away, so he ran off to find a stick. From subsequent readings of the book, I was later to realize that the dog pilot had never had the opportunity to fetch a stick, his appearances in the book being all too few, so he was obviously keen to take the opportunity when it presented itself. He must have known almost instinctively that the little girl who had momentarily appeared at the bottom of page 81 was unfettered by the rigidity of the narrative. He knew that he could stretch the boundaries of the story a small amount, sniffing along one side of the lane or the other, since it wasn't specified. But if the text stated that he had to bark or run around or jump up, then he was obliged to comply. It was a long and repetitive existence, which made the rare appearances of people like me that much more enjoyable. I looked up and noticed that the horse and rider had just passed the young woman. The rider was a tall man with distinguished features and a careworn face, bent into a frown by some musings that seemed to envelop him in thoughtful detachment. He had not seen my small form, and the safe route down the lane led right through where I was standing. Opposite me was a treacherous slab of ice. Within a few moments the horse was upon me, the heavy hooves thumping the hard ground, the hot breath from its velvety nose blowing on my face. Suddenly, the rider, perceiving the small girl in his path for the first time, uttered, "What the deuce?" and reined his horse rapidly to the left, away from me but onto the slippery ice. The horse lost its footing and went crashing to the ground. I took a step back, mortified at the accident I had caused. The horse struggled to gain a footing, and the dog, hearing the commotion, returned to the scene, presented me with a stick, and then barked at the fallen group excitedly, his deep growl echoing in the still evening. The young woman approached the fallen man with grave concern on her face. She was eager to be of assistance, and spoke for the first time. "Are you injured, sir?" The rider muttered something incomprehensible, and ignored her completely. "Can I do anything?" she asked again.
"You must just stand on one side," answered the rider in a gruff tone as he rose shakily to his feet.
The young woman stepped back as the rider helped his horse recover with a clattering and stamping of hooves. He silenced the dog with a shout, and then stopped to feel his leg. It was obvious that he had hurt it quite badly. I felt sure that a man of such dour demeanour must surely be very angry with me. Yet, when he espied me again, he smiled kindly and gave me a broad wink, placing a finger to his lips to ensure my silence. I smiled back, and the rider turned to face the young woman, his brow furrowing once more into a grimace as he fell back into character. High in the evening sky, I could hear a distant voice calling my name. The voice grew louder, and the sky darkened. The cold air warmed on my face as the lane evaporated, the horse, rider, young woman, and the dog returning to the pages of the book whence they had sprung. The room in the museum faded in about me, and the images and smells transformed back into the spoken word as the woman finished the sentence. "For he halted to the stile whence I had just risen and sat down."
"Thursday!" cried my Aunt Polly crossly. "Do try to keep up. I'll be asking questions later."
She took me by the hand and led me away. I turned and waved my thanks to the Japanese tourist, who smiled genially back at me. I returned to the museum a few times after that, but the magic never worked again. My mind had closed too much by the time I was 12, already a young woman. I only ever spoke of it to my uncle, who nodded sagely and believed every word. I never told anyone else. Ordinary adults don't like children to speak of things that are denied them by their own grey minds. As I got older, I started to doubt the validity of my own memory, until, by my 18th birthday, I had written it off as the product of an overactive imagination. Rochester's reappearance outside Styx's apartment that night served only to confuse. Reality, to be sure, was beginning to bend. Chapter 7. The Goliath Corporation. No one would argue that we owe a debt of gratitude to the Goliath Corporation. They helped us to rebuild after the Second War, and it should not be forgotten. Of late, however, it seems as though the Goliath Corporation is falling far short of its promises of fairness and altruism. We are finding ourselves now in the unfortunate position of continuing to pay back a debt that has long since been paid with interest. Speech to Parliament by English Goliath skeptic Samuel Pring. I was in the Specops Memorial Cemetery in Highgate, looking at Snood's headstone. It read, "Filbert R. Snood, a fine operative who gave his years in the line of duty. Time waits for no man. SO12 and SO5, 1953 to 1985. They say the job ages you, and it had aged Filbert a lot. Perhaps it had been for the best when he didn't call after the accident. It couldn't have worked, and the break-up when it came, as it surely would, might have been too painful. I placed a small stone atop his headstone and bid him adieu.
"You were lucky," said a voice.
I turned and saw a short man in an expensive dark suit sitting on the bench opposite.
"I'm sorry,"
I asked, taken aback by the intrusion into my thoughts. The small man smiled and stared at me intently.
"I'd like to speak to you about Acheron, Miss Next."
"It's one of the rivers that flow to the underworld," I told him.
"Try the local library under Greek mythology." "I was referring to the person."
I stared at him for a moment, trying to figure out who he was. He wore a small pork-pie hat balanced on top of a rounded head that had been crew-cut like a tennis ball. His features were sharp, his lips thin, and he was not what you'd call an attractive-looking human being. He sported heavy gold jewellery and a diamond tie-pin that twinkled like a star. His patent leather brogues were covered in white spats and a gold watch-chain dangled from his waistcoat pocket. He was not alone. A young man, also in a dark suit, with a bulge where a pistol should be, was standing next to him. I had been so wrapped up in my own thoughts I hadn't noticed them approach. I figured they were Spec Ops internal affairs or something. I guessed that Flanker and Co. weren't finished with me yet.
"Hades is dead," I replied simply, unwilling to get embroiled. "You don't seem to think so."
"Yeah, well, I've been given 6 months off due to work-related stress. The shrink reckons I'm suffering from false memory syndrome and hallucinations. Shouldn't believe anything I say if I were you. That includes what I just told you." The small man smiled again, displaying a large gold tooth.
"I don't believe you're suffering from stress at all, Miss Next. I think you're as sane as I am. If someone who survived the Crimea, the police, and then 8 years of tricky literatech work came to me and told me that Hades was still alive, I'd listen to them."
"And who might you be?" He handed me a gold-edged card with the dark blue Goliath Corporation logo embossed on it.
"The name's Shit," he replied. "Jack Shit."
I shrugged. The card told me he was head of Goliath's Internal Security Service, a shadowy organization that was well outside government. By constitutional decree, they were answerable to no one. The Goliath Corporation had honorary members in both houses and financial advisers at the Treasury. The judiciary was well represented with Goliath people on the selection panel for High Court judges, and most major universities had a Goliath overseer living within the faculty. No one ever noticed how much they influenced the running of the country, which perhaps shows how good at it they were. Yet, for all Goliath's outward benevolence, there were murmurs of dissent over the corporation's continued privilege. Their public servants were unelected by the people or the government, and their activities enshrined in statute. It was a brave politician who dared to voice disquiet. I sat next to him on the bench. He dismissed his henchmen.
"So what's your interest in Hades, Mr. Shit?" "I want to know if he's alive or dead."
"You read the coroner's report, didn't you?"
"It only told me that a man of Hades' height, stature and teeth was incinerated in a car. Hades has got out of worse scrapes than that. I read your report. Much more interesting. Quite why those clowns in SO1 dismissed it out of hand, I have no idea. With Tamworth dead, you're the only operative who knows anything about him. I'm not really concerned about whose fault it was that night. What I want to know is this. What was Acheron going to do with the manuscript of Martin Chuzzlewit?"
"Extortion, perhaps?" I ventured.
"Possibly. Where is it now?"
"Wasn't it with him?"
"No," replied Shit evenly. "In your testimony you said he took it with him in a leather case. No trace was found of it in the burnt-out car. If he did survive, so did the manuscript."
I looked at him blankly, wondering where all this was going.
"He must have passed it to an accomplice, then." "Possibly. The manuscript could be worth up to 5 million on the black market, Miss Next. A lot of money, don't you think?"
"What are you suggesting?" I asked sharply, my temper rising.
"Nothing at all. But your testimony and Acheron's corpse don't really add up, do they? You said that you shot him after he killed the young officer?